So welcome everyone to our fifth class in our series on the design construction in addition to Villa Vuoto, my own house. The first three weeks, we took a look covering pretty much the design behind the house, getting into some of the details on that. And last week we looked at the construction. We're going to get a little bit of the construction here today, starting off as well. I left something out last week in particular that tied in more to today's lecture, which is the blue bathroom that you're seeing through this window. We're going to see the tile that goes into that today. Today's lecture is, I pulled out as a separate lecture dealing with what I kind of refer to as like case studies. After moving into the house, I wanted to kind of live with the house and see how the house affects daily life, and then kind of really observe that. Architects generally kind of do that with their commercial work in particular. Residential work's a little bit harder, but they kind of do follow-up studies frequently just to see if the stuff they design is performing as it was designed, and if not, you know, where are the shortcomings, so they can kind of, in theory, improve as they go forward. It's not so much for me, kind of, that's part of it. I definitely am wanting to learn from this and improve going forward. But it's a chance for me to kind of ferret out some of the design ideas behind the house, which we got into pretty heavy the first couple lectures. And it's an opportunity, as an example, with the spaces being rounded, it's an opportunity, as the question was asked before, how that might be different than a house or a room that's more rectilinear. And we're going to get a little bit into that today, some of those differences. But those are the kind of things where I like to use the house or the structure, the architecture, kind of almost as a laboratory to be able to kind of study architectural space using the house kind of as a tool. So that's kind of the approach of the way that I approach it, not only my house, but also the other projects that I work on, kind of a similar vein. But obviously with your own house, you have an opportunity to real more intimately explore it kind of on the living side. And so today's lecture is going to kind of delve into that, explain some of the things that I've found with that exploration. Before we kind of jump right into that, though, next week is the final class, which we're going to have a tour of the house. For those, there's a map up front, kind of gives you directions on how to get there. It's next Wednesday during the regular class time. And 2 points on that. One, those that might need a ride, as far as kind of ride sharing, or those that have space that they can offer a ride. Either one of those scenarios, if you want to get in touch with me and let me know what the best way to kind of structure that, then I can kind of like connect you to sharing. In addition to that, if you miss next week's lecture or tour, also let me know if you're interested in getting kind of that last lecture. Let me know that you won't be there, and I can figure out a way to best kind of get that to you, because I'm planning to kind of record that lecture next week, so that way you won't miss out if you can't make it. So, we moved into the house on August 1st, was 1st of 2004 was our first day in the house after sleeping over the night before. And immediately, when we got into the house, we had our oldest son, who was about 2 years old at the time, almost two. He immediately started finding things kind of about the house that I didn't anticipate in the design of the house. And so one thing that I learned very quickly with design, creativity, is that children are much more creative than adults. And a large reason for that, I think, is two things in particular. One is that children kind of come to the game with a completely open mind, or empty mind is probably more accurate. And it's just because they haven't had that life of lived experience that's kind of filtering or tainting their experience in the moment. And so situations like this, rolling a marble on the windowsill, these kind of things, kids find almost immediately because of this emptiness in their mind. And in addition to that, they also bring this curiosity to explore. And so these two aspects we're going to kind of get into a little bit here today. But these are both things, this kind of like an open mind without this preconceived notions, as well as just the energy and the curiosity to explore really any opportunity that presents itself. These two types of things I try to bring to my architecture and as I work through a design. A third element that kids have kind of in spades compared to adults is more energy. That obviously plays out as well, but that's something that is not always in our control as adults. But the biggest experiment that's been kind of ongoing since we moved into the house is how rounded space affects the development of a child that would be growing up in that kind of environment. And so, as I mentioned in previous classes, our two sons are both off at college now. So they're, for the first time, kind of living in spaces outside of this space, as far as like on a daily basis. And so, and then obviously once they get out of school, if they don't come back home, they'll be out looking for a place on their own. And so that will kind of be the real next milestone in this experiment to see what kind of a place they select to choose to kind of live in. And I think that'll at that point reveal a little bit more as far as some of this development. But we're going to get into some of the kind of the, a few details pointing out how so far how we've kind of noticed or seen some of the impacts of them growing up in a rounded space. As I mentioned, with my architecture, I try not to limit myself as far as this open mind and curiosity on designs. One of the best examples that I kind of have to explain or illustrate this is actually within our own house, which is the blue bathroom, the shower curtain for our blue bathroom. So I thought I'd go over this a little bit. Initially, when we started out for this blue bathroom to create a shower, my work dealing with residential work, there's really only two types of showers that you come across. There's two types of shower curtains. There's a plastic shower curtain that hangs in the bath shower scenario. And then kind of a step up from the plastic hanging shower curtain is a glass enclosure. And so my thought initially was to try to combine the two together and see if I can make a hanging glass curtain for the shower was the initial thought. And this was partially because glass is a little bit, as a material, is a little bit more elegant than a plastic. They're both kind of translucent or transparent and let the light through, but glass just has a little bit more of a natural feeling to it than a plastic. But in addition to that, rather than the fixed glass enclosure that you typically get, the hanging aspect of a hanging curtain is also quite nice. It has kind of an ethereal feeling to it, just the way it kind of gently sways, moves from the movement of your body in the shower. And so that movement kind of gives the shower or the showering experience kind of a little bit more of a living essence to it than a fixed solid material. And so that was kind of the impetus behind it. So I started off with this drawing here and a few other drawings, kind of working through some designs. The idea was to take each one of these glass plates, have them made with, and you can see some holes to hang them, suspend them from a curtain or a shower rod with cables. And so I had these pieces, kind of worked with two sizes just to try to simplify the construction. Sent them out for getting a bid on having these made. They would have to, because they're in a shower condition where you have bare feet, and they have to be tempered so they can be safety glass to some degree, which also kind of adds for customization, adds some cost. And so I rapidly got the price back on a few bids on this, where it came in more than I was going to spend on the whole bathroom. And so immediately that was out, and I was looking to see this as a limitation or kind of a hurdle that you hit. And this happens frequently as you're working through a design. You come to a roadblock, and my approach in those situations has always been take that as a driver that's going to kind of inform the direction you're going to head. Because a lot of times, if you kind of just embrace it like a child, you know, you embrace it with an open mind. You're not fixed and married to this where you know, it just deflates you. And so the thought was, okay, you know, the cost is an impetus. Let's see what's the cheapest or the least expensive way I can make a hanging glass shower curtain. And so that was kind of like the goal behind it. So my first thought was to get some glass plates that right off the shelf, as opposed to having glass being made, custom made. And so I picked up some discontinued glass plates at Target, and I got some binder clips and just clipped them onto the plates. I was careful enough to select plates that had a little bit of a rim around the perimeter so that the clip would kind of hold on to it. And then I just use fishing line to kind of like tie the binder clip to the curtain rod. And so I started looking at, you know, different ways to hang it, you know, the backs to each other, which created a little bit more of a gap versus kind of like hanging them in alignment where they're a little bit tighter. And I just worked through different scenarios of how these would be arranged, you know, whether it would be kind of like a regular grid pattern. But the idea generally was to overlap them in much like a fish scale, so that way the water that's coming from the shower would kind of wash down from one to the other, and you wouldn't kind of, it could still serve its purpose that would allow it to contain the water within the shower. And so that's how it kind of evolved and grew. But one of the things that was nice discovery by going through this that was unexpected or unanticipated from that earlier design that I showed you is that working with, and this also goes back to some of our previous lectures, working with a pure circle, this plate form, as opposed to this other form that I created in the drawings. This is a much more simple geometry, a much more kind of like common geometry than the other form that just by the nature of it being an irregular form that's unfamiliar, it becomes something that calls attention to itself, whereas the circular form, because it's so common, your mind will tend to like not necessarily hone in on that perimeter of that form, and that's also something we're going to get into a little bit more detail here going forward today. But the thing that was interesting is that these kind of circular forms, which are almost kind of like ripples in water, but also just the shedding and also the way that the glass, because of the shape of the plate, distorts the image coming through the glass, the tiles that you see beyond it. Like the flat portion, you can see the tiles clearly, but then in these kind of like conditions, it distorts the tiles that are beyond it, much the same way that water distorts the image when you're looking through water. And so this result that I didn't plan for, didn't anticipate for, which I would have had like these flask glass pieces had I had them made, ended up creating this water metaphor that I was trying to create in the space with this grotto that I was trying to create that energy for, came through much, much clearer, and I thought much more sophisticated or elegant solution to kind of creating that feeling. And so it's these kind of like little surprises you don't anticipate when you kind of, much like a kid, you kind of embrace the these limitations that you're brought upon. A lot of times you'll discover other things that you don't anticipate, and quite frequently what you find is the end result is actually better than that initial thought that you had that you were trying to hold to.
And I noticed that there's spaces between the plates. Does that create areas for water to get out?
So it does in theory. In reality, one of the things with the shower, by having a larger shower, it's less of an issue as opposed to a tighter constricted shower. So in this particular case, it's a quite large shower, and it's not really, the plates are not, I mean, there's certainly, as far as them collecting water stains, you're aware that the water is on it, but it's not as big of an issue like those little places that it comes through. So about 5 months after we finished the shower curtain, my oldest son, Oscar, started in his bedroom, took some playing cards and started making this piece on his desk in his bedroom, which was an interesting thing. But the kind of the impetus of kind of creating, it wasn't uncommon because he was very much constantly making and tying things through the house. We saw a little bit of that in previous lectures. So this type of a thing wasn't unexpected, but the fact that he was kind of arranging it in a similar way to the shower caught my interest. More specifically, what I thought was interesting was kind of the way he was kind of taking ownership of it, that he was proud of kind of what he had made was significant to me because it kind of told, it told me kind of a way that you can take a design element or a piece and you can kind of use that to kind of, again, kind of to build this character into the person using it. So the goal of the bathroom was to kind of get it done for our deadline for the Pittsburgh Magazine. They were having their annual architectural design series. So we did get it in and we're fortunate enough to get it on the cover of the magazine. We also got, we had the Discovery Channel came out and did a series.
And
I wanted to play just a little clip for you.
But for him, the biggest reward is what the house has meant to his family. With its wild colors, bold themes, and unexpected twists and turns, it's given his kids exactly the kind of shot in the arm he and Julianne were hoping for.
I call this room Duck Heaven. I'm planning to get like a makeover of it with bushes everywhere, making it like a rainforest.
It turns out that out-of-the-box thinking is contagious.
When we created the house, we wanted to keep our minds open to almost any possibilities. We didn't want to have preconceived notions.
My favorite part about the bathroom would be just the open feeling. You feel as if you're involved with nature because of the large windows, the skylight, the shimmery color from the tile work and from the lighting. You feel at peace.
So this is just a small segment of that show that aired, but I wanted to show this to you because it was interesting that like the director that came out and shot the piece was so intrigued by our son as far as just so engaged into the whole process. In fact, he wanted he wore like this director hat and followed the camera guy around and was kind of giving him direction. And so it was to where they kind of included him in his own little segment of his own bedroom, even though the show was coming out to do a feature on just the bathroom itself. And it kind of goes to the fact that like our son has his own bedroom and he kind of like it's his kind of own domain where he can create this space for himself, much the same way that we kind of created this house for ourselves, in the way that I kind of try to empower my clients to kind of create a house for themselves. And so it's this idea of having this space that can, by taking some a little bit of this ownership, enables him to kind of not only define the space for himself, but also allow the space to kind of more closely kind of define himself. And so in that way, it becomes what I've kind of termed these spatial portraits, which we're going to get a little bit more into today. But it's a way of taking a space and creating a portrait, or in this case with him in his bedroom, it's kind of a self-portrait. But if you look at the space, I come to the space and look at it almost like a portrait, where I can look at how it's expressing this individual that lives in this space by the choices that they make for it. And so, the common theme with today's lecture, these things that I've been kind of exploring and looking at since we've moved into the house is thresholds. We talked about a little about these thresholds in earlier lectures, but what I found, which the house has kind of enabled me to really zero in a little bit more closely on what a threshold is, I've kind of broken into three different types of thresholds, which we'll go get into here today. The first one being limits, to where a threshold is kind of like the defining limits of a space. And so like the room that we're in here today, The walls at this point kind of act as that limit or the extent of the room is defined by the threshold of these walls that, that surround us. And so the key point of this is that the perception of these surroundings or the perception of these thresholds are dependent on materials. And so in this case with this room, it's the material of these walls that are materially defining these thresholds. But more specifically, which we, if you recall back from the earlier lecture when I was passing through the doorway, it's this part of our body that's referred to as somatosensory transduction, which is this this way of the your body's senses, primarily in your skin, are absorbing sensations from the environment around you. Everything from just air movement to temperature, various impacts from these currents that are in the space. Your body's taking those sensations to the skin, delivering them via neurons to your brain, and transferring those to sensations or feelings or intuitions that you have within your psyche. And so it's this way of taking a physical environment and with inside your body and your mind, transferring those to sensation that you have. And so it's this sensation of space is really what I'm interested in as an architect. And so it's the fact that this sensation of space or the thresholds in particular is being defined again by these material aspects of the surrounding. And so the actual, the context of the wall physically has an impact on that space, whether it's a cold or warm surface, these types of things. In addition to that, also another point, which is something that I came to realize that, it seems pretty obvious, but it's sometimes it's overlooked, is that space, a lot of times as architects, we talk a lot about space and form, form kind of defining space or space kind of being the absence of form, you know, much the way like a sculptor might define kind of like a piece of artwork. But in reality, this space that we see is not empty, it's not void. There's things going on in that space, everything from air that might not be visible to the eye, but there's all kinds of currents that are going through that space, electromagnetic currents, these types of things. And so it's the fact that everything that we contact and inhabit is fluid. And it's including the space that we're engaged with. And so it comes down to this variations of the density of this fluid or the proximity to these various variations in these currents within the space. Yeah.
How do you think Richard Serra would have thought about what you just shared?
So actually, I got a chance to talk to him about that point once. Pretty fortunate. When I saw in from the earlier lecture, his Torqued Ellipses had just come out in Los Angeles. I saw it in one of his installations out there. And you've probably, if you've seen any interviews or segments on him, you've probably heard this before, but he claims that he's not interested in the surface appearance of his work from a visual perspective. He's more interested in how the space is perceived and felt as you walk through the space, walk in and around his work. And it's this experiential aspect of kind of walking inside and around and through his pieces is really what he's trying to explore with the way that his pieces are defined. And so that's in a large extent my same interest, which is why I kind of gravitated to his work and used his work quite a bit to kind of inform the architecture on my own house, where the walls have that similar circular rounded shape and form as Serra's Torqued Ellipses, and but more particularly how these forms and shapes would impact kind of the experiential aspect of moving in and around it. So one thing, that going back to the shower curtains, like these glass plates, the circular nature of the glass plate as opposed to that kind of irregular form that I created initially, being familiar as this kind of circular element, your conscious mind, your awareness kind of just naturally kind of takes these familiar things and pushes them out of your attention, and kind of what pushes it to the ground, so to speak. And it's this idea that there's so many sensations we're taking in within the space, our minds would be overloaded. And so for our minds to be able to make any process, any sense of the experience that we're having within a space, it has to kind of like just silence and filter out the things that are kind of not novel, or things that are familiar, or things that are not a threat, for example. And so then that allows the things that are unfamiliar, that are novel, or that are a possible threat, to come to the surface of your attention. And so this aspect of pushing things to the ground or out of attention, and then also highlighting significant things to the forefront, much like we're seeing here with this these cave paintings. It's interesting that the individual that's making this painting of this bison is taking the form of the bison, and it's adhering it to the shape, the natural shape of the contour of this, of the stone on the ceiling, the way that the rock is kind of protruding out at a point here, creating almost like a three-dimensionality to the figure. So that way it's more than just a painting on a flat wall, it becomes sculptural. And it's this kind of drawing it out from the background, this idea of trying to give significance to the bison, kind of bring it to life by kind of bringing it out from the ground. And so this is the way that, you know, we perceive things is by the mind consciously taking 99% of the information and just silencing it and paying no attention to it, and focusing in on what is significant. In particular, another aspect with design is this idea of these feelings or sensations that we have within our culture becoming taboo. This idea that more attention is placed on the way that we reason rationally, think in our minds, more so than paying attention to these sensations that we have. Like if we go back to the very first lecture, you recall we were talking about Rowena Wade Reeds from Pratt, teaching about how to look at physical form and space and focus on the sensations that those space create, much like Richard Serra's torqued ellipses. And it's this focus on this these sensations that you have. A lot of times in our daily lives, we kind of suppress those feelings. We don't pay attention to those feelings, how it feels when you walk into the room. You have those feelings, and you might notice if there's something significant that stands out, but you very quickly kind of just push it aside and attend to these more rational, reasoned thoughts that we have. And this is a large part just this byproduct of this developing mind that's becoming this kind of reasoned mind, or what might term free will. This ability to where we as humans can choose to ignore these sensations that we have. We don't have to act on these sensations, whereas, so to speak, another life form that has less free will or no free will is kind of limited to acting on these instincts or stimulus, almost kind of like a response kind of way, to where we have the ability to again, to kind of push these things to the background and choose what we want to kind of put our attention to. And so in this particular case, this vanity form here is trying to kind of address or bring this point to it. Interestingly enough, vanity comes from the Latin term, which means empty. And so it's this idea of kind of going back to this void that we were talking about, that this vacuous aspect where a traditional vanity that we're familiar with, which is what I was trying to question and explore with this irregular kind of form of vanity that less common, is trying to draw attention to the fact that like these familiar vanities that we're very familiar with, I mean, there might be, as you go from one room to another or one bathroom to another, there might be a change in the countertop material, there might be a change in the way the cabinets or drawers are arranged on the vanity. But in generally speaking, there's not a whole lot that kind of catches your eye and unexpected. And so you very quickly with these vanities kind of push this again out of attention or awareness. It falls into this, this so to speak, void aspect. In a similar way, the shower curtain in the bathroom, the term curtain draws again from a Latin source of the word court. And court, or like a courtyard. And in this way, it's a similar thing to a void or vacuum that you might find because a court space is kind of like an opening or a spatial opening within a larger form. But in my mind, it's more to the idea of the courtyard is kind of the central hub or the heart of where the activity happens. People are kind of drawn to these courtyards to kind of interact and mingle and spend their time. And so it's kind of the essence or the heart of the home. And so in this way, the curtain kind of is referencing not so much kind of like the void of the vanity, but more kind of like the essential aspect of a curtain or an activity. And so in this case, in particular, the fact that the curtain, this curtain is arranged to where it's hanging translucent, it's creating this kind of ethereal aspect or essence that I'm trying to recreate. And this just enables by trying to hone the essence of this, it enables the piece to kind of take on its own kind of being or its own existence, so to speak.
How would that hold up over time?
How's the idea hold up or the shower itself?
The shower itself.
The shower's held up pretty well. My wife, when I initially pitched this idea to her, was not a fan of it because she was worried about how this was going to get cleaned.
Yeah.
That was, like I explained to her, was part of the genius, was with the binder clips, you could unclip all of them and throw them in the dishwasher and rehang them. That, in all honesty, has never happened.
But that, she wasn't going to do it.
But at least it helped to kind of sell the idea. So, as I was mentioning with my son's bedroom, I've kind of taken this idea of these spatial portraits, and I approach architecture in a way that, like these elements, like the shower curtain, the vanity, they are elements within the space that are specific or have meaning to an individual that's using the space. And by doing that, the space becomes almost kind of like a biography or a portrait of that individual. And so, the way that I've approached my projects is I like to document the work after it's completed, but then I also document the individual that's living in the space, so that way you can kind of pair the two together and you can kind of start to see connections between the individual, a portrait of the individual, as well as kind of a portrait of the space, and see kind of where those see if there's any threads between them that you can kind of discern from these kind of documents that I do with the photographs. And so in some ways, the bathroom becomes kind of like a self-portraiture for me in that regard. But in addition to that, because this is a house for more than just myself, I'm trying to also bring our children as well as my wife into, in a similar way, kind of engage them into having it become a portraiture of them as well. And so I wanted to go through here quickly some of the tile work that went in, just to illustrate some of this. So the thought was initially, being a fan of Gaudi, the broken mosaic tile work, which he was a master of, and also just the forms, the kind of the way it rolls up the walls, creating kind of this free form aspect to it that you're familiar with Gaudi. Started off with, again, lines on the wall. When we finished the space within the room, it sat kind of vacant for a number of years once we moved in because we didn't want to kind of rush the space just to get in. We wanted to kind of take some time and do it well, knowing that it was going to be a space that we're going to enjoy using going forward.
And so I had the plasterers when we first started, this is this Venetian plaster I mentioned before. I had them just plaster the top half of the room, knowing that the bottom half would get this kind of treatment of tile. And so initially I just scored a line to kind of show the plasterers where to kind of plaster to. But then after that, I went back and refined that profile, that division between the plaster and the tile, specifically where that wanted to be. So you can see here in this case, a few lines being drawn, really trying to work out, you know, in more refinement, that transition. And so you can kind of see where the vanity is coming in over here. You can see that line being worked out in relationship to the window openings, the way that the kind of space flows around. In this case, with the vanity, it's roughly going to come in at this line. You can see that the tile is coming up above it to create kind of like a backsplash for the vanity that it work around the toilet and transition to these different elements as it goes along. And so this was all, again, going back to this idea of working it directly in the material as opposed to working on a piece of paper and working this line out. This line could be done on a piece of paper and then a piece of paper being given to whoever's carrying this out. But working directly in the material, I think, offers some things that the abstraction working in paper or model form loses in a lot of cases. Initially, the idea was to take these square mosaic tiles and fill this space in, which you can clearly see from what resulted. That would have been a colossal oversight. So that eventually came out when I decided to go the route of the broken mosaics. And so this line kind of carried around through the space. And then you can also see some design sketch around when I was working out some different patterns for the shower curtain itself. Some thoughts and ideas. Then we got samples made for some tile glazes that we were working out, trying to get to a couple different color variations within the tile. Then I created this drawing here. Where I was just showing some movement patterns through the tile that I wanted to express, kind of like the fluidity to the two individuals that were going to be laying the tile. At this point, I realized I had a deadline. There was no way I was going to put this tile in myself, which was the initial thought when this square tile was laid. So I brought in two individuals I work with on my other projects that do tile work. They were available and. So they came in, and so at this point I was trying to convey some of the ideas to them. And so here you see some drawings on the walls where they're working out some of these bubbles, ideas that they had, swirl kind of patterns. And again, they, much like me, they were just working right on the wall, trying to work these things out and see just proportionally to the body in the space. How that works to you. Here you can see ripping out the tile that I had in before. We made a decision, you know, that no one was really a fan of this. There had to be something else, and that's when I got the thought, you know, well, let's do Gaudi's broken mosaics. So we left the perimeter of this on just to kind of define that kind of like a clean transition as opposed to bringing kind of like the broken mosaics and having kind of an irregular edge between the plaster and the tile. Then I started to form the vanity top and the wall screen for the toilet. This was one of the individuals, Sarah, that worked on the tile. Interestingly enough, a point here. This is so we're kind of standing in the doorway to the bathroom, and then directly opposite is this window. Which, if you recall back, there was this reference to the blue grotto that we were trying to recreate. This is the opening to the grotto that's going to bring light from the opening across the floor, which would be metaphorically the waters of the grotto. And so Sarah had this idea of using white tiles to kind of in different shades to kind of create some of this light effect across the blue tiles. I'm not a fan of white, so I didn't push back, kind of like trusted her. One point that like this area over here is kind of opposite. As you come into the room from the doorway, and you'll see this when you come out to the house next week. This is the first spot that you see. It's the first spot that kind of opens up as you come in. So I knew it was a pretty hot charged location. And so I mentioned to them in the beginning. I said, you know, we need to do something special here because of that. And so they,
as a result of that, they took kind of that direction
and they started out with that spot first. And you can see here she worked through some colors that she was bringing in, then she took the colors out, thought she wanted to stick more with just like the blue palette
and make it a little bit more subdued.
And then that spot kind of like ran into some of this other
movement that's going through the rest of the tile. But the point that I wanted to make was, and this was a lesson that I learned from this particular situation going forward,
is that one of the things I like to do is to work with these artists on the architecture. Like Sarah, for example, is more of an artist than a tile subcontractor. And use their artistic sensibilities to bring something to it that's not there that I'm kind of putting out. And what you find is that when you give them a direction and they try to achieve that, you limit that kind of ability for them to kind of just have a little bit more freedom and bring something to it more than what you have in mind. And so as a result of that, this probably spot, which was the most charged spot, is probably the worst tile, in my opinion, in the whole room, because there was so much focus on her trying to get this right, and also to get it right first, as opposed to kind of getting warmed up with the other stuff and then working to it. And so she hadn't kind of gotten the feel of the space when she started laying this tile. And so by extension, the tile over by behind the toilet on this wall is probably some of the nicest tile in the room, but it's the tile that's kind of tucked out of sight over by the toilet. But that, you know, just the complexity of the way this is working, the colors, the forms, the shapes worked out much nicer. So from that experience, when I bring these artists in, I give them very general oversights. Like in this example, with this room, I told them I want shades of blue and I want a kind of metaphor that refers to this grotto, and that was the extent of it. I didn't give them any other direction than that. So for example, like rounding the corners where the transition here was something that they brought. All these figures, the mirrored bubbles, these were all things that they brought to the table.
I think also they were making the tile themselves.
That's right. So they'd bring out these slabs and different textures and different glazes, and then they would break them on site and then lay them. So they very much kind of puzzled them together on site.
They were picking the glazes and firing it. Making them into sheets and breaking them. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, we'll see a little bit of that here going forward. So you can see how these forms are kind of like rolling down across the seat in the shower, across the wall. No, they've all held up pretty well. That's also a key part about it is Matthew, the other individual that was working on this, to Aaron's point, not only was a tile layer, but he more specifically was a tile maker, custom tile maker. So he understood kind of like the engineering behind the adhesives and the different types of clay. And so trusting that judgment, you can never go wrong. You can see it grabbed the attention of my kids watching kind of like this process go in.
How much time did it take?
So it took them exactly 1 month from the time they went in, started putting lines on the wall, to the day that they finished. I started with the deadline because it sat empty for so long, and my wife was saying, look, we need to get this finished. The only way you get things done were deadlines, and so I kind of looked around for a deadline. This Pittsburgh Magazine deadline was literally 1 month out. And so I said, okay, let's see if we can knock it out in a month. And so the vanity, the plumbing, all this kind of stuff was going in simultaneously as the tile work was happening, because the tile work itself took a full month. In fact, the kids kind of had a little bit of, they bring these pieces out much like this. They take, break them up with a hammer and then kind of lay them in. So I gave them a spot in the bathroom to kind of like put some tiles in. So So yeah, it took about a month, and then the grouting came in after that, which was a different individual that did the grouting work. You can see here, you can see some of the pieces, to your point, as they were grouting, some of the pieces popped loose, like you can see here. We just kind of left them out. You'll notice, actually, if you know Gaudi's work, a lot of what is nice about some of Gaudi's mosaics is the voided spaces more so than the tile itself, the kind of in-between spaces. And so those spots where you had some tiles pop out created some of that looseness that you don't get when everything is perfectly fitted together. As long as you can get it out before you put the grout in, because you obviously don't want it coming loose once the grout's in. But that's what kind of like the guy that was putting the grout in would check each piece and make sure it's solid. If it had any little give, he would just like pull it out. So then with the vanity, you can see here working in the actual sink location in the top. Once we had the floor and the walls done, they started tiling the vanity. We had a couple drawers here that slotted out. By this time, we were waiting on this piece being made by a third individual, Sherry, that is more of a sculptural artist in clay. So she made this three-dimensional vanity. The idea was to kind of have this bowl that went all the way to the floor, but we didn't have a kiln large enough to do that, so we had to limit it a little bit. But we were waiting for this thing to kind of dry, because you don't want to rush the drying, because that's when it could potentially crack in the firing. And so we didn't want to put it in the kiln, pull it out, and have a crack in it, and have to kind of start over. So we waited till the very last minute to fire it. And so that went in last after all the other tile work had been done. But what was interesting is, again, kind of going back to Gaudi, you have this irregular form of the bowl itself, and then kind of rolling that down to the flat surface of the vanity top and kind of bringing that up around the sides just creates this more sculptural feel to the opening that this creates for the bowl. And then the shower rod came in, so that way we could hang the curtain, which we did in one night, which is why it's kind of dark. This was literally, I hung the curtain after he got the rod in, spent the night kind of putting it up, and then early in the next morning taking pictures and rushing it down to take the pictures in and enter in for the contest the next day. So with that, we had this in the house. This is the living room off onto the left and the kitchen off onto the right. There's a two-step difference between the two spaces. During construction, the crews kind of just laid some boards down at this point so they'd have a step up, because it was like a big step. And so those boards, which were just 6x6s, two 6x6s laying there, they sat there literally through the whole construction. And then once we moved into the house, they were still there because we didn't put a step in. And so we were stepping on this 6x6 framing for quite a while. Let's see, 2014, so for 10 years. And so then my wife decided, kind of inspired by the bathroom, decided to put mosaics on the boards and create just a decorative step. Then a few years later, we took our first trip to Barcelona. Took in some of Gaudi's work, and so then from that we came back home, and then she was inspired even more to tile a table, which you can see here. And you can clearly see the influence of Gaudi's tile in this. Coming back from, this was actually literally the same year that we took our trip to Barcelona. Later that year, she put this table together. And so it was this idea of, again, taking these things within the space, in her case, this table or this step, but these various elements within the space, and kind of like taking some ownership or having them an expression of herself through this. Like these forms that are in here, she has this narrative of the symbolism or the metaphors that they represent in her life and related to our family. But it's curious that not only does the tile work have clearly elements of Gaudi,
but even just the forms themselves also have some reference to the bathroom, these forms that were created by the tile installers there. So with that, we'll take just a 5-short break here and pick it back up.
Very close to you, but I can't make that because I have a class that comes before this. So is there a way that I could make a time to visit with you and see the space that's convenient for you?
Yeah, we could do that.
Okay. I'm sorry.
No worries.
Yeah. But I, you know, I live 5 minutes from you. I'm curious if your kids were in the same class as my kids.
I'm sure.
I live on campus and I will be driving. I have space for 3. So.
I'll just email you, and that way you'll know. But I'm Eleanor Avigad, so.
Thanks.
But my kids are 25, 23, and 20, so we might have had some overlap.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Nice.
But your kids went to Bradford Woods, right?
They did.
Yeah, we were Marshall.
Okay.
We live right off of, Richard and Matterhorn. I'm on Matterhorn.
Nice.
In the back part of Matterhorn, so. I don't know why we go to Marshall, but
yeah, it's crazy how they divide the lines.
It is ridiculous. Yeah. I would have preferred Bradford Woods, but
it was nice.
Smaller school.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, it was. Yeah, but like when we found our lot, I mean, we had no idea. Like, I mean, we knew there was the different elementary schools, but we had no idea one from the other.
Right. Well, I didn't either.
And so until you're in, and then you're kind of.
We moved in 98, and our first was born in 99, and you know. I mean, you were thinking just a school district.
Right.
You weren't thinking about...
Exactly. Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yep, that's right.
Good. So where do they go to school?
So the oldest one's at Virginia Tech.
Okay.
And then the youngest one just started down at Florida Tech.
Okay, so I think your kids are 1 year behind mine because my oldest, she's in grad school. The second one graduated last year from WashU. So he's a senior, I guess, your Oscar?
Junior. He's got one more year after this.
Okay. So she's going to med school next year. And then the youngest is a sophomore at Cornell.
Okay.
Engineering. So.
Nice.
Virginia Tech, what does he do in Virginia Tech?
Mechanical engineering.
Okay.
Yeah.
And she's got a really good friend at Virginia Tech, but she's a sophomore. She's not an engineer. And it's a big school.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
It's a nice school, though.
Yeah.
A nice campus.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. How's Florida?
It's nice, too. Yeah, I mean, it's the setting. His school's like right on the coast, so the setting's
nice.
Me as a student, there's no way I could focus on school. Like, I'd be down at the beach every day.
Yeah.
But he's managing, doing well. So.
And what is he studying?
He's studying flight to become a pilot.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what a great place to do it. You get all the time to fly.
Right.
Here it's more of a challenge.
Right. Yeah.
Well, that's exciting.
It is.
You'll get a private plane. And
I know. That's what I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, right?
To what?
The hinges.
Oh, right. Yeah, we actually missed that last week. We got into that a little bit.
Oh, great.
The table that your wife is working on.
Yeah.
Interior, that's not outside.
We use it inside, yeah. So the kitchen is round, and we use it in the center of the room, kind of almost like an island, is the way we use it, because it's kind of standing height. it's not a seating height table. So we kind of use it as a portable island in the center of the room.
I haven't done that yet. I guess it's too late now.
Who's your metal guy?
So John Walter with Iron Eden, and he's in Bloomfield, did the metal work, including the hinges that you're seeing on the door here.
Speaking of the door, as was mentioned before the break, the idea of threshold, I kind of break into three groups, or three categories. We saw a little bit of it before the break. The idea of limitation, where the limits that the threshold kind of defines,
The way that these currents and these fluids within a space kind of like just expand to those limits, they just continue to kind of flow until they reach a limit or something that kind of stops it. And that stoppage or that limit is one way to think about threshold. Another way that we're seeing here is a door or an opening kind of in that limiting perimeter becomes kind of like a passage through that limitation. And so that passage through it is also another way to think of a threshold. So like as mentioned in the earlier lecture, standing in the doorway, as you stand on the exterior here and then you walk through this door inside, the sensation of these spaces of the exterior and the interior are very different in very many different ways. And that the door becomes this demarcation of where you transition from one to the other. So these openings that are in these perimeter thresholds also become a type of threshold that marks this transition or passage between one side to the other. And then the third aspect, also touched on before, the vanity or the shower curtain or my wife's table. These elements within a space that I kind of really intrigued me the most in regard to thresholds, because it kind of gets to this idea of spatial portrait. It kind of has this narrative that relates to an individual that's using the space, becomes a part of them, or it makes the space meaningful, I think is really the most important part of it. So I kind of refer to these elements as vehicles. It's a vehicle or a way to kind of like make a space meaningful to you as a user of that space.
The plants seem very formal. It almost goes against the sort of informality of the rest of the house.
You said the plans or the plants?
Plants.
The plants. Oh yeah, 100%. I'm not a fan of the plants.
In fact, actually, you'll see next week, I took a little bit of a stab at this, or a jab at this. In homage to Sarah passing away, I created a little landform up on the hillside, kind of like a little Sarah-esque thing, that will ultimately, as it grows over from the greenery, and it'll become kind of like a topiary, in a more Sarah, as opposed to a classical topiary here. But you're right, it's definitely and so to that point, these become kind of like this third type of threshold, these vehicles. Like this topiary becomes a vehicle that clearly defines a classical aspect that's not reflected in this door as a vehicle, that has a whole different kind of feeling or vibe to it. So you can very quickly, as astutely notice as you see this, that there's a disconnect there. And you can see the kind of like what brought this and what brought this was likely from two different minds, or if it's from the same mind, it's something complex going on there.
Well, they're almost like they're standing guard.
That's right. Yes, exactly. So one of the things that we've done over the years is that as we have people come through the house, this was a crew that came out and filmed a show for the HGTV on the house, had them take pictures. But as people come through the house for the first time, I ask them to kind of like pose in front of the door, just to kind of like create what you're seeing here today. Here's the people that worked on the tile. Create this montage of some of the people that have come through the house, just as a memento for us more than anything, just to kind of remind us of those experiences when they visited. And so over the years, this is a class of high school students that had I had a design competition that I hosted for students. So I'd bring the winners to the house and kind of give them a tour of the house. And so over the years, we've, as you can imagine, we've accumulated quite a few of these photos.
I'm friends with
Yeah, actually, we'll hear a little bit of her work here in a few minutes. Here's some more of these students. Some of my son's friends live down the street. Some more students from the design competition. To Aaron's point, here's Tadao on the right-hand side, a woodworker. So a lot of these individuals are people that I work with in my own practice. We're going to see one of his doors here in just a few minutes. Here's the crew from that shot the scene that we saw earlier from the Discovery Channel when they came out to shoot the bathroom. Here's another door that we're going to see in a few minutes, the powder room door. You can also see in this, what's nice about it, it's kind of a progression. You can see the kids kind of growing up, which is nice.
And the plants keep changing.
That's right. Yeah, where did the topiaries go? I like these a little bit more so. So inside the house, the openings, again, these kind of thresholds between one room to another, the openings were, I stuck to one particular form just to try to make it simple on myself as far as building this thing out. The front door had these rounded sides, which required me to have these custom hinges made. I didn't want to make custom hinges for every door in the house. So I made one side a traditional kind of upright hinge side, but then I arced the other side to give it a little bit of variety, and then also played with the top. And so this kind of simple form was the opening that I used in these doors. But knowing that, this is not like your traditional door. Each door would still have to kind of be custom made for the openings. And so again, thinking like we mentioned last week, trying to keep budget in mind, I made the point that I designed the house in such a way to minimize the number of doors that I had inside the house, just so that way I wouldn't have as many to make. And so I was able to keep that down to, I think, 7 or 8 interior doors. So speaking to that, Tadao, this woodworker that I work with, this was a door for our bedroom that we put in. So we lived in the house for a number of years without doors inside because, again, it took time to kind of make each one of these doors. So this was an anniversary present to my wife. The first door we put in was our bedroom door. This is a magic trick that my son in sixth grade, he created this trick where he makes his friend disappear walking inside this door box. It was 4 doors. It was interesting. We kind of salvaged these doors, so they're traditional doors. But this was him growing up without ever having an experience of dealing with a door. And so it was kind of a little bit foreign to him, and you actually kind of tell that because here the door is upside down, where the handle is up. He's, you know, not really familiar with what handles are for. This was actually the second door to go in the house was his own bedroom. He got to be a teenager, and so I said, okay, you know, teenage passage right. He could put a door on his bedroom. Because prior to this, we were just using curtains in the doorways, kind of like a 60s vibe. And so he designed this door with like trap doors on the bottom. He even created like a device to where he could have an alarm go off if you came inside. And then the third door that came in was our powder room door. As you saw earlier, this was a door that a dojum door from Africa that we used to install into the opening. The door itself is kind of a traditional square door. The opening had that irregular shape. So as a result, you had this opening that the door didn't totally fully close. So you can see some of the curtain that we used prior. So as a result, we have kind of like door and curtain kind of like in place for the powder room. But the significant thing was we got, by this time, we had gotten a 3D printer. And so we printed this hinge that the door would kind of pocket into and pivot off of and use this printer to kind of create the hardware for installing the door itself. For me, significantly, what was interesting is the leaking aspect of the door. The door doesn't fully close and seal off the room like a traditional door would. And it's not only leaking light, but it also leaks, as you can imagine, sound, odor.
And so it's this door that's not precise or has the precision of what a door typically is trying to do, which is to seal off a space. But by doing that, this being the powder room, as a guest comes over to use the powder room, they're fully aware of this door when they go in and use it. As opposed to, if it did function correctly, you might come in and use door and not even notice it. And so it's a way of, again, trying to deal with these thresholds of taking the elements and how do you craft it in such a way that you take more notice of them as opposed to just pushing them kind of to the ground where you don't even take them that notice in.
So before you had this door, how did your guests feel about using the powder room?
They, you know, only the most bold guests would use it. the ones that, you know, were apprehensive, they would go upstairs and use one of the bathrooms upstairs. And so, you know, even just that act alone kind of like told us something about the people that were coming in, you know, so it was a way to kind of define not only the person, but also the space. And so it's not so much this trying to torment our guests, but it's this way of trying to explore the elements and see how can you design the elements so that way you are drawing attention to the significant things. And what you find also too is that by using this space, they're learning something as a guest more about us, our house. And they're also starting to question themselves or say, you know, what kind of a person has a house where I can't even, you know, use the guest bathroom comfortably, you know. But at the same time, you know, if they ponder a lot and reflect, they might say, well, you know, is that, you know, where are these kind of like traditions in society? You know, it makes them like start to question, much the way we did with the whole house in general. Taking these norms that we take for granted and don't even think about, questioning them and saying, is this a norm that we should keep? Or is this a norm maybe we should change because there's something better we could do? And that's not to say this is better, but it's something that was just a way to kind of like challenge at or explore it. And so then our youngest son, when my wife was working on the table, got inspired to make a door for his bedroom, which he started working on.
Are you familiar with Risenstein School?
I am not.
Oh, well, that was built, it no longer exists, but it was built with an open concept of no doors.
Nice.
No, it failed.
Oh.
It put the doors in eventually. Well, that's how Hosack is. Hosack Elementary in North Allegheny.
Right.
It's no walls, no, and it still exists.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like right in the office space with the open floor plan for the commercial office was an idea, you know, and now, you know, and then everyone gets these cubicles. So that openness is certainly something that's is explored. So that one of the last doors that went in was the hall bathroom on the second floor. This is the bathroom that the two boys' bedrooms use. Up until just this past year, we had the curtain there, and as you can see, the light coming in from the window in the bedroom, in the bathroom, kind of like pulls through the curtain, which is quite nice. So my oldest son ended up making a door for the bathroom, and he maintained some of that light came through by using a translucent panel here. And then also, interestingly enough, he does it with these mosaic pieces, very similar to the bathroom, and even more to the point, you can see some of the figures are the same type of figure that you see in the bathroom carrying through, that also carried through the table. And so these elements, here he's doing it also kind of characteristically of himself or the way that he works, which he'd been doing from as a kid, making these constructs throughout the house. You can see kind of like the roughness to it, which is intentional, but also, if I back up here, you can also see the fact that the door also, much like the powder room door, is not a precision seal. And so a lot of these aspects are still carrying through, which I find fascinating because it speaks, again, it's a vehicle that kind of speaks to this portraiture of the person that made it. And so another way that I kind of explored the house as a kind of a tool to study these thresholds was I wanted to look at the way a space is perceived acoustically. Our senses, you know, our visual sense is our most dominant, strongest sense. And in a lot of ways, these things that are kind of pushed to the background are pushed to the background because this visual sense is kind of like in a dominant way taking over that. And so exploring these other senses that we have, including sound, which is probably the second most frequently used, second to visual, was something I was very interested in, how the forms of the space acoustically define kind of like the sense of that space from acoustical standpoint. So with that,
could you back up real quick and describe that space?
Yeah, just real briefly here. So this is the main living space here. This is the front door that we've been seeing some images coming in here from the front entryway. Here's the powder room that leaks that you can see is directly off of the main living space. Central staircase that goes up to the second floor. So the kitchen is down in here, which is open to the living room. So the first floor is kind of an open floor plan. Off to the side here is a little dining space where it's off of the kitchen, kind of family room where we eat. And then back in here is more the functional laundry and pantry type thing.
Fireplace.
What's that?
Fireplace.
Yes. So. In the main living space, the fireplace is here, sits, and then also next to it here we have a TV that hangs on the wall. So generally speaking, these are kind of the three points in the room that kind of like orientate in this direction towards the fireplace and the TV, and then also kind of balancing that out are these 6-foot diameter windows here, one on the right, and then one also on the left. This axis here is a due east-west axis, so the door faces due east. And then this window faces due west. The way that kind of like light comes through the space through the day is in regards to that. But sitting kind of in this part of the living room, kind of orientated this direction towards the television and the fireplace and the window view outside is generally the way that the space is kind of arranged and structured. So one of the things I did study kind of the acoustics is a friend of mine, Tatiana, that plays viola, had this idea of coming through the house and playing her instrument through the house in different parts of the room and kind of move about the space and listen acoustically to the way that the space kind of unfolds as you move about. And so this drawing to some degree is kind of an illustration of that. In this particular case, what we found was for this particular room, this was the sweet spot where sitting in this spot, regardless of where she kind of moved about playing, would always sound the best. Kind of like the shape of the room kind of brought the sound together to this kind of sweet spot.
And so each one of these rooms, we went through and kind of did what would be more of a, again, more of a laboratory setting kind of study of the space acoustically, more so than like a performance idea of the way of listening to a piece. So I wanted to play just like a brief piece here. This is a sample where one of these studies up in our bedroom. And if you listen to this, you can hear acoustically, you can hear the transition from the bedroom into the closet, walk-through closet. That leads you to the bathroom, the blue bathroom we've been looking at. And you can hear that acoustically. And so you can also, if you listen closely, you can kind of hear that space unfolding. You might not know because you're not seeing it or familiar with the room enough to know precisely where she is in the room, but acoustically you'll be able to hear that movement that there's clearly a change in the space or the way she's moving about. Before I play that, I also want to make one other point. So in talking to her over the years, she came up with this idea of, so Bach is one of her favorite works that she likes to perform. And so with Bach, the German word for night is Nacht, which sounds, you know, similar to Bach Nacht. But then also Nacht is very similar to Nacht, which is naked in German. So this kind of duality between night and naked, which also have a very similar kind of alliterative to the word Bach, gave her some ideas where the idea of performing at night where it's dark, you take away that visual sense. So that way, by taking away the visual sense, then the other senses kind of naturally your attention hones in on. And so it's this way of trying to enhance the auditory by taking away the visual. And so this idea of kind of performing in the dark was something that she was interested in. And so we've kind of, over the years, explored this idea of taking spaces like my house, for example, and having performances within the space with the without the lights on, or in the evenings when you can turn the lights off. And so you can kind of like take in that acoustics. And so if you want to kind of play along when I play this, you can kind of also close your eyes. And so that way it helps you to kind of not be distracted by this visual, and it help you maybe hear kind of acoustically the transition of the space. Kind of in a similar way that you heard, like acoustically, this kind of palpable difference from as you work through that piece, you get a similar thing within the space itself. That kind of palpable sensational difference that's mostly accented here acoustically. Some of you that just a couple days ago with the eclipse might have had a similar experience if you went out and kind of took a look at the eclipse. It's a situation where This when this eclipse happens, and kind of like you get this darkening of the space to some degree, it got a little bit cooler, the air got a little bit cooler. You had all these kind of like very subtle things that were happening, but it was perceivable. When you were out there, if you were really paying attention to kind of get these sensations that your body is taking in with all these various senses that you have, there's a palpable difference. And so it's this this sense of space that's changing as this is kind of unfolding. To where this nature, for what was intriguing to me was the fact that this eclipse is this physical thing, much in the architectural sense. You have these two physical bodies, the sun and the moon. Just the fact that they're eclipsing is now impacting the surface of the earth in the ways of the temperature change, the light change, all these various aspects. And by doing that, you're also sensually aware of those changes perceivably. Even if your eyes were closed, for example, in this situation, you would pick up on some of these nuances. You might not know specifically what's going on because, again, we rely on our eyes so much. But for me, that's what I found interesting. In addition to that, you know, if you recall, there was an eclipse a few years back in 2017. This was at the time I told my sons the story about how an egg will stand upright during an eclipse because of the gravitational alignment, which they didn't believe, but sure enough, it worked. Another thing, like with these pinholes that I'm sure you've heard of this past week, we took like a strainer and like the light coming through these pinholes change. You can see the eclipse kind of projected through the openings. But also, interestingly enough, with the house, kind of having this skylight here in the kitchen, it almost becomes this oculus that plays this kind of light down and through. And I got the same effect as the strainer, the light that was coming through the trees and the leaves. We got these eclipses that kind of projected onto the floor, using the house kind of like as this giant pinhole camera, so to speak. But what also is fascinating is to think that like this sun is coming through the woods, the trees that surround our house, is traveling. Let me see what the number is here. It's half a billion feet from the sun to the moon, and in this case here, it travels. Just imagine this: half a billion feet. This sunlight is traveling. And in this case, it's reaching the floor of our kitchen unobstructed, or you know that distance. But this light over here, in the last foot, you know, is being blocked out. You know, and so it's fascinating that something can travel that kind of distance. Again, kind of architecturally through this like distance of space, these proximic relationships, the way that you can take architectural form and you can use that with these elements like light and water and these really core natural elements and use that for the way the space kind of unfolds in this case in shadow and light. So with that, one last point here, one last experiment that is still unfolding, which you'll see next week when we get out there, is the addition onto the house. I show this artistic work here, which is from the 1930s, by an artist that was like questioning this nature of a teacup by putting this fur on it. And again, it's going back to this experience that you have drinking tea. As you can imagine, it would be quite different drinking it out of this cup than a traditional teacup. And in that way, you know, architecturally, you can see kind of remnants or in the work itself, as far as like the way that this has been used over the years, this kind of being worn down by the feet climbing these stairs. And this speaks to again this the nature of these kind of thresholds that you have within space. In this case, the thresholds being less material and more kind of cerebral, or in this case, a physical material object that, as we're all familiar with, has completely radically changed our society. Not only that, but just the experience of the space. Again, this goes back to what we've been saying earlier about how we push and ground things outside of our attention that we're having because of these various elements. So one of the things that I've been questioning with the addition to the house is I've been dealing with, and some of you might recall this from my past class, where we talked about Neri Oxman and her dealing with these materials that naturally biodegrade. Thinking about a more kind of environmental way to build as an architect, to where the amount of energy that goes into building a construction and having that construction over time just naturally degrade. To where a client, I was just having a conversation this past week with one of my clients. I'm doing a restoration of a church in Millvale. They're building out an acoustical sound studio within the space. And this church is over 150 years old. So it's a pretty ornate, architecturally speaking, church. And that's partly why they're restoring it, is because it has so much character to the space. By contrast, down the street from my house, which you'll pass if you come next week, is a church that also has a quite large community following. But this church, when we first moved into our house, at the time their group was growing so rapidly, they built a new facility, a new church for their group. And that structure went in, and then literally within about 10, 15 years, somewhere in that time period, they outgrew it because they continued to expand. So rather than kind of like adding on to this church, they just completely tore it out, and then they just built a larger structure, which they currently have today. But it speaks to the point that the average house in America has a lifespan of 34 years, is the length of the average house today. And even more to the point, the commercial space, like an architectural church, for example, my one client has a church that's over 150 years. It's been staying, continues to stay, and the fact that they're doing this restoration with it will probably continue longer, whereas the church down the street didn't even last 15 years. And so, as architects, the current approach to kind of like environmentally sustainable green building is this idea of making architecture that is robust, durable, to stand 100, 200 years, with the thought, the idea that the more durable it is as construction, then the more usable it is, even if you adapt that use over time. Whereas in reality, the church down the street that was torn down within 15 years, had they spent all this time and energy, money, material, energy, to construct this durable church to last 200 years, and then literally tear it down 10 years later, all of that kind of energy and is lost. Or becomes a burden onto this kind of sustainable type thought. So Neary kind of has taken this to where let's create architectural materials that naturally degrade and kind of return back. And so I've kind of taken this approach to my own house with this addition. So we're standing inside the addition here. This is the deck that the addition is being built out over. So this deck is was finished when we moved into the house in 2004, so it's 20 years old. It's in the process where it needed a little bit of restoration because it deteriorated over time. And so as I was opening it up, came to discover that the not only was the deck boards themselves, you can see some of the rotting that was happening to them, but I suspected as I was walking around replacing some of these boards, there were some soft spots in the roof between the joists. We have a rubber roof here that covers over the basement below us. And so these soft spots, I couldn't figure out why they were soft when I was stepping on them. So I cut an opening out. Lo and behold, the plywood that was underneath it had all rotted away. This is a very familiar, what's referred to as brown rot. It's very stereotypical because of the brown color, but also the way that it takes the lignin and it breaks it up into like these cube type shapes and forms. And so this got me to thinking, as also I explored even further, went through the plywood. I have insulation, spray foam insulation on the underside of the plywood. This is the basement ceiling. And so I saw, I realized that essentially this spray foam insulation was the only thing holding up the ceiling at this point. And so I took a few samples to document the material itself and trying to explore how quickly this stuff was deteriorating and trying to figure it out. And in large part, wood fiber deteriorates from mostly, well, it's a fungus that's eating away at it, but the large part of it is a lack of sunlight and too much water is a two contributing causes. Here you can see the posts that are going in for the addition that's sitting on this, that you can see some of the growth of, is taking to the legs of the post for the addition. So pulling this out, opening it up, allowing some sunlight to get into it, allowing the air that now can circulate to kind of reduce the amount of moisture, kind of slowing down that process. But the reality is the trees that surround my house are covered in these fungi that eat and eat away. I mean, this is their whole kind of calling in life, is to break down these materials over time. And so rather than kind of working against that, I thought, okay, is there a way to work with it? And so once I got the deck up, I replaced it with new decking that went down. And then I put a bubble wrap foil on top as a moisture barrier. And then the idea, my wife wanted, as opposed to the wood deck, she wanted to go with a stone deck. This is something you should never do as an architect, is to put stone on top of wood. Generally, you'd want some type of a base to it, some type of masonry base. But because it's my own house, I was wanting to kind of like take some risk and experiment a little bit with this. More importantly, putting all this weight on top of something that's eating away and kind of like deteriorating is not a good idea either. But that said, put this in. And I wanted to do it in what's referred to as a dry lay, where you don't have mortar in between. And I use pea gravel to kind of choke in the space between it. And that locks in the larger pieces. And so these are literally just dry laid onto that surface without any kind of a mortar set. And the thought is, one, to eliminate the amount of material as far as the mortar, but two, to allow the water on the surface to kind of percolate through this and drain out naturally. Despite the fact that I was a little bit worried about this, last year I was teaching a class at Pitt on falling water. And so I was going through some of the drawings that Wright had put together for, here's his cantilever that falling water is so well known for, the railing out here. And looking at the details, which I did not know this, it turns out that Wright had taken his cantilever is concrete. But on top of this concrete, he's got a 2x4 that he lays, and then on top of the 2x4, he had wood planking that he put on top of that. So he's got his wood planking supported by the concrete with a sill plate, which is a very common detail. But then on that wood planking, he put in a membrane, a rubber membrane, and then he put his 2-inch of stone. So that cantilever that he's got at his house, or that transitions from inside to the exterior of his cantilevers, he's got sitting on the wood. It's the same detail that I was doing on my own deck. So when I saw this, it gave me a little bit more confidence knowing that Wright went that route, and falling water seems to be still standing. Interestingly enough, you can see the detail, the striker, like redwood. Some of the changes that they made as they were going along, the most importantly, is working out this flashing connection between the wall and the floor here.
I have a question.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. So the stone that I had laid there, I only laid it on half of it and left half of it open this past winter to see if there was going to be any problems. I could see the difference between the two. We didn't get a whole lot of snow this past winter, so I didn't get a lot of a test on that.
This one you just had inspired by, did he grout that stone, or is that dry?
It's grouted in. His grouted stone is the first, and it's also sealed. The stone is sealed. So that's his first line of defense for the water. His membrane underneath it is his second line, trying to prevent it from getting to the wood. The approach that I'm taking with the deck is I'm taking humidity readings in the basement just below that deck. And I'm tracking the humidity inside in the basement relative to the humidity outside. And I'm just kind of like watching. And the idea is that, again, this deck that's being eaten away, because there's no way to go in, even if I wanted to do this right, no pun intended, but there's no way to go in and clear out all of that rot and then replace it, especially in the wood setting where you have these spores that are just in the air. You're never going to get rid of all those spores and all that rot. It's there. And so the best way to manage it is to keep the conditions, the moisture and the sunlight, to a situation where it minimizes or eliminates the amount that spore is eating away at the material. And so this is precisely what the thought is here, is to take and monitor this, with the idea being that a 50% relativity of humidity is kind of the sweet spot that you want to hit. Anything above that, you're getting too much moisture, and you're getting, therefore, deterioration of the deck much more rapidly. Anything below it is also a different type of concern as well. And so the idea is to try to maintain 50% humidity. But the thought is that trying to project out how long this house is going to last, its lifespan of the house, how long it's going to last, kind of Neri Oxman's idea of a very more sustainable type of building, is that ideally you could time it
to where you kind of like control the growth of this decay to where it's eating away at your deck, but then when the house is no longer needed, it kind of reaches that point where it fails and it kind of naturally kind of returns back, is the idea and the thought behind it. To the point where I've even given some thought to like the anchors that you use to assemble the materials together, the screws and the nails that go into architecture to assemble materials. Much if you look at the medical industry, you look at these like dissolving stitches that they use when they stitch someone up, rather than like in the past where you had to go in and then have the stitches removed physically, now they use materials that just naturally deteriorate. Once it's kind of served its purpose to hold the thing together until the thing can heal. And so you could do a similar thing with architecture where you have screws and nails that, you know, you go to the, you know, Home Depot and you pick up a 5-year nail, a 15-year nail, 150-year nail, and with the idea that this architecture will stand for this like span of time, but will naturally be, all these assemblies will just kind of like deteriorate and then kind of collapse on its own weight.
It's time.
So with that, we'll pick up next week for those that you can make it out, and we'll take a look closer at the addition, and you might not want to walk out on the deck now that you've kind of seen it. Thanks, Matt. Thanks.